see.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fogring, and the show is Fight the Empire. And my guest today is Jeremy Kuzmarov, who is a co-author of a very interesting book called The Russians Are Coming Again. The First Cold War is Tragedy, the Second as Farce. And Jeremy Kuzmarov is a professor of history at the University of Tulsa. And so, Professor Kuzmarov, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Well?
And it's Tulsa Community College, yeah.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I was wondering about, you know, it's got a very interesting cover on this book. It's a picture of, it's like a city scene, and it looks like it's a kind of a cemetery with, you know, a fence around it. And then there's a tree with a coat on a hanger that's kind of attached to this tree, and I'm wondering what this picture is of. It's kind of very mysterious. I can't find any reference to what it actually is, but it is a very interesting. Go ahead.
We weren't sure ourselves because the editors selected it, but I think it has some significance. It's a kind of Russian image. And I think it's just kind of symbolic of ugliness of world politics.
Well, I might say that this book, its publisher is the Monthly Review Press, and the title is The Russians Are Coming Again, and co-authors are Jeremy Kuzmarov, my guest, and John Marciano. But getting into the Russophobia that's going on, I've been around a while, and I can't remember a kind of a propaganda blitz as sustained as the one we're in now. So can you kind of go into that a little bit? I mean, this is in your first chapter.
Sure,
you talk about the New York Times, and that's our paper of record. The Times and the Washington Post have been sort of pushing for very aggressive foreign policy now for, well, years and years and years.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, it goes back 100 years. There was a study by a famous journalist, Walter Lippmann, was a co-author, and they found a repeated pattern of bias in the New York Times was a specific focus of their study. You know, from the time of the Russian Revolution, the reporting at that time, was very biased against the Bolsheviks and was predicting their defeat. You know, I think they predicted 100 they would be defeated 100 times, and it never happened. So it does go back a long way. But, yeah, what we're seeing is a very relentless campaign to demonize the Russian regime of Vladimir Putin and to make all kinds of accusations. You know, the standard of journalism has often been very low because the articles make allegations without proving those allegations. So it's more a matter of yellow journalism. And like with the election, they repeat over and over again that Putin, you know, hacked into these emails that you know, exposed machinations in the Democratic Party against Bernie Sanders. But actually, a study by the Intelligence Veterans for Sanity found that it was an internal leak, not a hack. And I mean, we don't know for sure where the truth lies, but we can't conclude at this point definitively that the Russians were behind that. And yet it's reported as if they did it, you know, they're guilty without the evidence. So that's a very disturbing trend. And it's, yeah, whipping up a lot of Russophobia and hysteria that's leading us into a new Cold War and possibly even a nuclear war.
Well, I think one thing that really disturbs me, and I listen to a lot of news on NPR, and like you said, the, you know, the... the guy's name is William Binney. He was with the NSA for 30 years, and he came out with this article that it had to be a hack because, not a hack, but a leak, because it would take too long. The time signatures on this material that appeared that there was not enough time to do it from a hack, and so this is a very specific point he made. And it's been totally ignored, you know. Like if the people who are saying it's a you know, Russian hack, if they would deal with this statement, that would be one thing. But they ignore it as though it never, basically as though it was never said. And I find that really very that kind of calls into question everything else that they talk about.
Absolutely, you know, it's very disturbing. And, you know, they talk about fake news as if it's only the domain of the Republicans and Fox News, and we know that that is a big problem. But unfortunately, it's also liberal outlets who have their own agenda. And, yeah, I mean, most recently, you know, they were presenting a number that, like, the Russians, you know, reached 126 million Facebook users. But actually, if you look into it a little bit, the counsel for Facebook had testified before a congressional committee, and he said that the number was actually much far less, and that 126 million number encompasses years going up through 2017, well past the election. And you know, he was also saying that people only read 10% of their news feed. So, you know, these social media. That the Russians were allegedly trying to confuse or, you know, divide people over social media, they're exaggerating the numbers who they may have reached by, you know, 100 times at least or something like that. So they're creating the impression that, you know, millions of people were reached when it may have been, you know, a much smaller number. So, and, you know, Gareth Porter had a piece about that recently on Consortium News. So that's just another example of misleading reporting, greatly embellishing the numbers, and just exaggerating what influence the Russians may have had in the election. But, you know, this bias extends in many realms because, like, the conflict in Ukraine has been covered in a very biased way, and it's often left out how the United States was behind the coup d'etat in 2014, you know, that triggered the conflict there. Mm-hmm. So it's just been a very biased reporting.
Well, they leave out the fact that supposedly pro-Russian president who was kicked out in Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, that he was actually elected. He was democratically elected, and he may have been corrupt, but so apparently are all the other politicians in Ukraine. So it's,
And also they leave out the people who were protesting didn't get enough signatures for impeachment, and that there was supposed to be another election coming up. So they're bent on regime change. They could have just waited for the next election and ousted him through the ballot, but they didn't have, you know, they didn't have enough signatures for impeachment. So it was a clear coup d'etat, but it's just completely that is all left out of the story. So, you know, Russia is depicted as the aggressor and Ukraine, and, you know, Putin's this monster who's bent on invading Europe and this kind of thing.
Well, this is another question too, as like why would Russia want to invade, say, Lithuania anyway? Russia has so much empty land, and they're trying to get people to settle it. Why would they want to invade and enlarge their holdings anyway?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I spent a bit of time in Russia, and I've read quite a lot about the Putin regime, and what I've got, the sense I've got is that it's a very calculating and pragmatic regime, and it's not a regime that would engage in kind of reckless action. I mean, it has done some questionable things, like in Chechnya, but I think overall, yeah, Putin is just a very shrewd and pragmatic leader. And he has improved, I mean, Russia's economy has improved a lot since he's taken over. So he does enjoy quite a lot of support in Russia. And I think he's too smart to engage in kind of reckless folly. And the way he's presented in our media is very biased.
Well, apparently he wants to, he made all kinds of overtures to the West early in his presidency. And in fact, even the New York Times kind of liked him at first, didn't they?
Yeah, that's what we found, yeah, because in our study, we went through the New York Times reporting over the entire course of Putin's presidency. And yeah, the first editorials were very favorable about him, saying he was pro-West. And I mean, I think we know after 9/11, he was one of the first to, you know, express his sympathy for the American people for that terrorist attack. So he was not somebody who came to office very hostile towards the United States. It was only through a number of, you know, gradually the relations broke down for a variety of reasons. But I think, you know, within Russia, he represents more moderate wing. You know, there are more hawkish elements in Russia, just like we have here. And he's often the one trying to kind of restrain them. So as I was saying before, yeah, he's more kind of a calculating and pragmatic, cautious leader. So that's why, yeah, we suggest this Cold War is a farce, because the first Cold War, I mean, yeah, the, you know, Stalin was, you know, a brutal dictator. So there were reasons, although ultimately we find that there was a great exaggeration also in that era about the Soviet threat. But nevertheless, I mean, Stalin was a monstrous leader. There was some truth behind the depictions of Stalin. Whereas in this era, yeah, we're dealing with a leader who's rather sensible. I mean, he's not the greatest, you know, person, and there are some bad aspects to his rule, but there are also a lot of positive things about Putin, and he's really not a threat to humanity in any way. So,
well, I've read a lot of his statements, and I've heard him, speak, and when you compare him to some of these American politicians, it's really amazing. I mean, he's very—he seems very modest, and kind of doesn't—he doesn't go over the top or make threats or anything like that. And where some of these American politicians, I mean, they're always threatening war and all sorts of denunciations and everything else. It's quite a contrast, but.
I would agree. And I met with, when I was in Russia, I met with a fairly high level person, Alexei Pushkov, who's close with Putin. And we had a very intelligent, you know, a very intelligent man and very sensible in his views towards world affairs. And so I think that's what you get with that, you know, Putin and his circle. They're bright people, and they're, you know, mostly sensible in what they say.
One thing I wonder about, you know, we keep hearing sometimes people say that, well, Putin is supposedly the richest man in the world, and he's got all kinds, he's got a yacht, and he's got all kinds of mansions, but my question is, when does he get to enjoy all this stuff? I mean, if Putin has a yacht someplace and he went on board, I'm sure it'd be in the news all over the world. I mean, when... And most of these dictators who squirrel away wealth, you know, they put in a Swiss bank or something, you know, eventually they retire and get to enjoy their wealth. But when does that happen for Putin anyway?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, well, if you watch the film The Putin Diaries, yeah, his main hobby seems to be playing ice hockey. And, yeah, he's not that good at it. So, yeah, I think that's, you know, there have been all these accusations with no hard evidence. And, you know, I interviewed some people in Russia, and they said, yeah, there's no evidence. There is evidence that Yeltsin was corrupt, and that his wife and others in his circle, but no hard evidence has come to light. And I think sometimes, you know, they're counting things that, you know, the Russian president inherits certain housing and stuff, it belongs to him for the period he's a president, and I think they're counting that as part of his alleged wealth. So, it's just a part of this demonization, and a lot of it is just rumors or falsehoods being bandied about as fact in our media.
Well, in your book, you go into the something that should be in everybody's history book, is the U.S. invasion of Russia back in 1918. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. And unfortunately, public opinion polls show that very few Americans at all know about this. I think one poll in the late 80s showed only about 10 or 14% knew about it. So, it gives some perspective on U.S.-Russian relations even today, because, we're always told about the Russian menace and the Russian threat, but Russia really has never come close to invading us or doing what we've done in Russia. And that was, and of course, the Russians have a longer, historical memory and better historical knowledge than we do. So, it's a basis for Russian distrust towards the United States and West, which is legitimate even to this day. And, it was a really illegal intervention by the Wilson administration after World War One. With the Russian Revolution, the Russian revolutionaries took Russian troops out of World War One. And that, triggered the U.S. intervention in support of the ex-Tsarist military officers who were trying to overthrow the Bolshevik government, whose first step had been to take Russian troops out of World War One. And the United States allied with some very reactionary people, including in Siberia, Admiral Kolchak, who was far from democratic in his methods and was actually employing torture and a lot of violence and brutality that was driving most of the population into the arms of the Bolsheviks. So the United States was really on the wrong side of that civil war, and they were supporting a lot of atrocities, and U.S. troops committed a lot of atrocities. It's kind of a prelude to the Vietnam War, because they were fighting a popular revolutionary force, and they couldn't identify who the enemy was, because he was hiding out in towns where the people were supporting him. And many soldiers came to question what they were doing there, and some even mutinied. And so ultimately the United States had to pull back its forces, but it was a pretty ugly episode in U.S. foreign policy. And the Wilson administration had deceived the public, because he claimed that the United States was just basically there to protect some property and force neutrality, when really there was a counter-revolutionary mission.
Well, my opinion, I guess, but I think Woodrow Wilson was greatly overrated.
Yes, I think so. I think he was did some terrible things, including sending U.S. to fight in World War One, which led to the deaths of 100,000 Americans or so, when there was no real reason for the United States to get involved in the European conflict. So,
well, basically, World War One was kind of a conflict between empires. I think of all the nations, and I think I counted it up one time, about 7 or 8 or 9 different empires were fighting it out in Europe.
Yeah.
England, France, Germany, Austria, Hungary, Belgium, Netherlands, they were all empires, they were basically fighting a lot of it had to do with carving up Africa.
Yeah, absolutely. So the United States really had no reason to intervene there, but he was bent on doing it, so. And he had campaigned. He said his campaign slogan was, he kept us out of war, because nobody in the U.S. public wanted to go to war. But then he flipped within a few months. So,
It's kind of a recurring theme in American politics.
But
tell us, let's go on to, the Cold War that most of us, well, a lot of us remember. A lot of us are not old enough to remember the Cold War, but I do, and it was very strange, because a little kid, you already go to the Saturday matinee and they have a little newsreel, and you'd see the Russians fighting the Nazis on the Eastern Front, and they were sort of presented as heroes, And it wasn't long after that, everything reversed. All of a sudden, Russia was our enemy, and it was very, very confusing to a little kid.
I could see that, yeah. I think today it's kind of forgotten often, the incredible role that Russia played in defeating the Nazis. The United States wants to claim all the credit for itself, but the Russians sustained something like 25 or 27 million casualties, and much of Russia was destroyed. And that also, places some context the paranoia that developed, because I think very quickly, the American public was, came to be under the impression that Russia was, going to invade Europe and invade the United States. But, I mean, Russia had been devastated by World War II, and much of the population had sacrificed itself in that epic victory. So, in hindsight, it's clear that the Russian, threat was greatly exaggerated. We argue in our book that the Cold War was preventable, that there was really no reason, for the United States to adopt a hostile position when they had cooperated in World War II. And, Roosevelt and his vice president in World War II, Henry Wallace, were pursuing a policy of cooperation. But in 1944, there was a kind of coup. Many historians have called it a coup d'etat in the Democratic Party that ousted Wallace, who wanted to continue Roosevelt's policy of cooperation in favor of Truman, who was more pliable leader and could be manipulated by the so-called military-industrial complex who wanted a conflict with Russia.
When you go into George Kennan and the so-called Long Telegram, can you tell us a little bit about that? Because he was a very influential guy back then.
Yeah, and that was, the shift from the Wallace-Roosevelt policy of cooperation ultimately, broke down with Truman's elevation, and the guiding basis of U.S. Cold War foreign policy was the containment doctrine advanced by Kennan, who was this influential diplomat. But, Kennan had a very Russophobic outlook. He considered Russia like a country that was kind of like in the East, and that was prone, naturally to Oriental despotism, as he called it. And there were, a lot advanced, I think, by Kennan and others, in his circle. So the idea is that, Russia is an inherently backwards country. But he was suggesting that the United States shouldn't invade Russia. I mean, they didn't. That would be foolish. But the United States should try and contain Russia's expansion. And should focus on intervention in vital regions of significance to the United States, like the Middle East because of its oil, Western Europe, Japan, and Southeast Asia. And I think Latin America was considered part of the U.S. domain. So that became a basis for quite aggressive U.S. Intervention in many different countries as part of the containment doctrine.
Well, one of the things he wrote, besides a long telegram, was a presidential policy statement number 23. And basically it said that the U.S. has got, 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6% of its population. And he was saying that our foreign policy ought to be to keep that disparity. In other words, he dispensed the sentimentality and daydreaming, he said, and our attention will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. So he was not quite the, he was not a warmonger in the rollback sense, but he wanted to keep this disparity of taking the world's wealth, which actually persists to this day.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's really what it was all about. The Soviet threat was greatly exaggerated, and that created a justification for intervening all around the world, to support really U.S. hegemony and U.S. economic dominance. And there were ultimately, many coups that were supported, like in Iran in 1953 and Guatemala in 1954, that were, basically driven by naked economic interests, like oil interests in Iran, and the United Fruit Company and its interests in Guatemala, but they were publicly justified under the containment doctrine and the need to fight communism. But it was greatly exaggerated that the Russians had the capability of expanding in all those countries.
So where are we now? I mean, we seem to be, you know, one of my big concerns is, you know, Donald Trump is kind of really so crazy. Right now, they're trying to figure out what he means by taking the troops out of Syria. But my concern is that that Trump has got so many people kind of spooked, and that if they get, you know, if they find a way to remove him from the White House, that the public will kind of breathe a big sigh of relief and let the regular elites go on with their plans for war. Is that a rational concern?
I think so, yeah, because unfortunately what we're seeing, and yeah, I mean, I share your view and the view of many people that Trump is an erratic person and very dangerous individual. But unfortunately, I think this, you know, anti-Trump movement is also quite questionable, because often when, you know, Trump does do something reasonable, like when he tries to meet with North Korea or tries to meet with Putin, they're attacking him, you know, from a kind of right-wing perspective, that, oh, he's a traitor to American interests, and that he's, you know, selling America out. And so that's not healthy either. I mean, I think, you know, our, you know, president meeting with adversaries is a good thing, and, you know, could play a role, like in the Korean crisis, which, you know, seems to be there's some, you know, positive prospects there. So that would be a good thing. But, you know, so, you know, it leads to questions as what are the interests, you know, behind or trying to, you know, co-opt the anti-Trump sentiment in the country, yeah, to their own agenda, which may be a very regressive agenda. And we've seen that, unfortunately, you know, in recent years, the Democratic Party has evolved a very hawkish party, you know, away from the days of George McGovern completely to, you know, the Clinton and Obama. I mean, these kinds of leaders were promoting many wars abroad, often, you know, covert operations, drone strikes, coups like in Ukraine. Hillary Clinton had her hands behind that. So, unfortunately, American politics, yeah, there's no real force for peace in, you know, in the anti-Trump resistance right now.
Well, I guess part of maybe we have this weird, you know, Trump is kind of crazy in a very loud, obvious way, but I really think that, say, guys like Zbigniew Brzezinski, they're kind of nuts in a very quiet way. You know, Brzezinski had this really phobia against the Soviet Union, and, you know, that's why he did this little number in Afghanistan supporting the you know, the jihadis, the mujahideen in Afghanistan, in order to give the Soviets a taste of Vietnam or something like that. And we're still living with the effects of that. I mean, that led to Osama bin Laden and everything else, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. And Brzezinski was a key advisor to Barack Obama. And I think he, you know, was pushing for very aggressive policies like in Ukraine. And perhaps ultimately a goal may be regime change in Russia against Putin, because Putin is more of a nationalistic leader, and he doesn't, you know, bow to the dictates of the United States like they would like. So I think, yeah, he was still active, you know, he died last year, but he was still very influential in the Obama administration in pushing those same kind of, yeah, very reckless and dangerous policies. And yeah, we also saw the Asia pivot, I think, is very dangerous. You know, what's unfolding now with China is that, you know, the U.S.-Chinese relations have deteriorated, and the Obama administration had initiated the Asia pivot policy, a military buildup in the Asia-Pacific region, which is antagonistic towards the Chinese, and that could lead to conflict in the future as well.
Well, some military guy just said that the big danger is China. Well, we're kind of the end of our time now. We've been talking with Jeremy Kuzmarov, the co-author with John Marciano, of this very interesting book, "The Russians Are Coming Again." It's a good history of almost everything that's happened since World War I. So I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you. My pleasure, yeah. I'm sure we could talk for another hour. So.
I think we could. And actually, I read an article you wrote about Kagame in Rwanda that this is another topic I'd like to go into sometime, but not this time around. But thank you very much.
Another time, yeah. Sure. Okay, my pleasure. Yeah, thank you.
So stay tuned to KBOO, your radio station.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor a screening of the film From Shock to Awe, A Journey of Hope and Transformation on Thursday, January 10th at 7 p.m. at Regal Cinemas, Pioneer Place in Portland. The film hosts the path of two combat veterans from the Iraq War as they live with post-traumatic stress, the lack of effective treatment, and their search for healing. This is a crowdsourced event and tickets are currently available for purchase. There will be a brief Q&A following the film. Again, that's a screening of the film From Shock to Awe, A Journey of Hope and Transformation on Thursday, January 10th at 7 p.m. at Regal Cinemas, Pioneer Place, 340 Southwest Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Today on Flashpoints, we continue our journey down the rabbit hole known as the Pentagon's budget. We speak with Pierre Spray, who spent 20 years developing weapons for U.S. military contractors. Then we take a unique look at the reaction of the Afghan diaspora in the U.S. as the State Department, the Afghan government, and the Taliban agree to direct negotiations to end the war. All this and more straight ahead on your daily investigative news magazine, Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And my next guest is Pierre Spray. He is